Older married women are to show younger married women what is good. But what is it that is good for young women to know and believe? Let me give you some viewpoints. The married woman knows that love is, at its best, an inadequate reward for her unnecessary and bizarre heritage of oppression. Since marriage constitutes slavery for women, it is clear that the women's movement must concentrate on attacking this institution. Freedom for women cannot be won without the abolition of marriage. If life is to survive on this planet, there must be a decontamination of the earth. I think this will be achieved through an evolutionary process that will result in a drastic reduction in the population of men. The institution of marriage is the chief vehicle for the perpetuation of the oppression of women. It is through the role of wife that the subjugation of women is maintained. Well, it is a viewpoint. It's a common viewpoint out in the world. To call a man an animal is to flatter him. He's a machine. The author of that particular quote, her document was the Scum Manifesto. The Scum, the acronym, Society for the Cutting Up of Men. Yes, exactly that. That is one view. Marriage is an institution that is extremely oppressive and dangerous for women. It is important for us to encourage women to leave their husbands and not live individually with men. But as I read them, and I haven't read all the quotes I've got, do you not sense with me that there is antagonism? That there is anger, there is frustration, there is hurt, there is no peace in the minds, in the hearts of these people who are writing these things? Let me give you another view. Love your husband. Love your children. Be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, and submissive to your own husbands. Two widely different viewpoints. One could almost say at opposite ends of the spectrum. Now, one of the very many wise statements that Jesus Christ made was, "By their fruits you will know them." By their fruits, what are the results that come out of these teachings? One of them builds up and promotes a healthy society. But the other is aiming for fragmentation, aiming to pull down and to tear up. Which of those two viewpoints promotes stability and peace? Which one promotes warfare? Which of them engenders hatred, disrespect, strife between the sexes? And which encourages love and respect and support? It's clear, is it not, that if you look at the consequences of the radical feminist viewpoint, and you look at the outworkings of those statements, you don't see anything that is good. You see something that is utterly destructive. And when you look at the outworkings of the words of the Apostle Paul, you see something that is totally different. Something that is beneficial, something that is designed to help and assist and unite. In Proverbs chapter 14 we read, "The wisest of women builds her house, but folly with her own hands tears it down." Since the sexual revolution of the 60s, women have become ever more and more mere sex objects and less free. They are being forced to be like men and not allowed to be women. The house that was built on solid Christian principles has been torn down, is being torn down. And people pretend it's better to be homeless, because that's how they are. Feminism, however, is merely one assault on the Christian faith. There are many others. It is only one. And I don't want to concentrate upon it. I don't want to concentrate on that which is bad and damaging, but rather to look at that which is good and beneficial. So let's look at Paul's instruction for older women. They are to teach the younger women how to be godly, how to be truly beautiful. They are to teach and to train the younger women to do the things, really, that they themselves have learned through experience to do. And they, through their experience, have learned that these are the best things to do. Now, that's not saying that those lessons were easy to learn. Those lessons could have been very difficult to learn, but they were learned. And there was a benefit, a solid, lasting benefit to those women who are now older. And now those benefits are to be passed on. Now the results of their experience are to be handed down. And this training by the older of the younger is going to be needed more and more in the church. Younger women who are converted from non-Christian backgrounds, they've never had a godly role model. They've never had someone teach them how to make their homes attractive places for families. They don't know necessarily how to properly love their husbands and their children. Worldly feminism and other isms would tell them to forget your families. You must find fulfillment in a career or in a, if the old one is going off a bit, in a new and a better and an improved romance. Godless publications tell them all about freedom. But that freedom is merely being captive to Satan. They tell them how to make themselves beautiful. But that beauty is external. That beauty is fading despite all the application of science and Botox injections and all the rest of them. God, through Paul, is saying, I want to make you beautiful women with a beauty that will last forever. Not a fleeting, fading beauty, but one that will be with you forever. These things are good. God describes these things as good. But some will say that it's not possible to do these things, at least not for them. It's not part of my nature to be like that. I'm not built that way. I can't love my husband and my children. I can't be pure. I can't be kind. It's not in my nature to do these things. And I would agree, it's not in our nature to do those things, is it? Our nature is very different from that. Our heart naturally is in rebellion against God, against these ideas. Our character would be one that's utterly selfish were it not for the grace of God at work in our hearts. And we must never forget that. No, naturally we can't do these things. But through the grace of God, we may be able to work and do them. These things are to be taught, as I said last time. And if they are to be taught, it means they can be learned. For 30-odd years, I was paid to teach children how to do fractions, how to learn Pythagoras' theorem, how to understand differentiation and integration. I was taught, I was paid to teach them those things. And that meant they could learn those things. They could learn how to add and divide and subtract fractions. They could learn what integration was all about. I had to teach. They had to learn. Paul says, teach. So learning can take place. It wasn't easy for all my pupils. Indeed, for some of them, they never really grasped everything about some of the differential calculus, but they had a good go and they made some progress. Now, in schools today, well, yesterday, because I'm not there anymore, I suppose, there are numerous strategies to help children learn. And this is one of them, training. The older women are to train the younger women. In school, you get some children who help other children, who get alongside them, who point out their mistakes. They work collectively, collaboratively, explaining where the problems are, explaining why you went wrong on that one, because later on it'll be explained the other way round. It's working together. Children are not left alone to discover these things for themselves. So why should it be that in the Christian church we expect individuals to learn these things by themselves? Can we not work together as a family, helping one another to learn the things that we need to learn? Help should be available. You older women, how do you train? You younger women, how will you learn? It's a two-way process involving effort, involving trust, possibly a bit of sadness and hurt on both sides. But this is the challenge. This is the challenge to you older women, to you younger women. How will you get on? Paul gives us a maintaining the educational themes, a syllabus, a godly syllabus that has seven aspects. Oh, and may I just add, there is no description as to what constitutes an older woman and what makes a younger woman. I'm sure that at times some of the younger women may be quite old in one sense and vice versa. It just depends on where you are in your Christian life. It depends on what you know, and it depends on the problems you face. You may have faced a problem, and you knew through the grace of God, and you solved that problem. And actually, someone who's older than you in years is facing the same problem now. You can help that person who's older than you. It's not strict chronology that we are talking about. But this sevenfold syllabus, and I'll try and get through all seven. One, love your husbands. Women are here, in effect, told that they are to love their husbands. Usually it's the other way around, is it not? Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Now that's the role model for all love. But we would, I'm sure, find it very hard to believe that women were not expected to love their husbands. But love is not that hit and miss thing that the world talks about. It is something that can be learned. It is something that can be developed, increased, improved. And even marriages that are suffering problems can be repaired through the grace of God. Love is something that godly wives choose to have for their husbands. It's not based on the fact that their husband is worthy of their love, but on God's command. And it's developed by an affectionate, by an obedient heart. If you look at the last of the seven aspects of this curriculum, it talks about being obedient to the husband. At the start we have love, and at the end we have obedience. That's the framework on which every marriage can develop and flourish for the glory of God. Love and obedience. Those are the two pillars, if you like, on which a godly marriage grows. But what if a young wife doesn't love her husband? she must be shown how to do it. She must be told, this is how you develop love for your husband. You do things that are loving for him. You put his interests, his welfare before your own. You put his preferences. It's not for the sake of a thank you. It's not for the sake of love in return. Where there is genuine, practical love for someone, then the emotional side of the love will follow on if it's not there already. But the world has it the other way around, doesn't it? The emotional comes first. In fact, it's the stars in the eyes, that leap of the heart, the tingle that runs up and down the spine. That's the be-all and end-all. Women are urged to let love be their guide. They are to love whom they want and when they want and how they want. But any relationship that's based on that, what's it going to be like? It's going to be temporary. It's going to be one of convenience. And it's one that will be abandoned when it becomes inconvenient. The woman is to love her husband. She is to express her love in practical as well as physical ways. To be considerate of all that he does for the family. To encourage instead of put down. To be supportive and not argumentative. There's going to be an element of friendship, an element of the romantic. One of adoration, one of tenderness. And as ever with any Christian love, there's going to be that reflection. Pale, poor it may be, but that reflection of the sacrificial love that Christ had for us. Love that puts the other one first. Now, in our society, perhaps more and more with the influx of many Muslim families, we can see that this actually works. In many countries, marriages are arranged. They're arranged by the family of the couple who may not even have met each other before they get married. So how can they have any love for one another? In the sense of love that the world thinks of, that emotional bubbling up. But they get married. They grow into love one with the other. Their families show them how love is to be nurtured, how it is to be improved. They show them what love is and how to grow it. It's not artificial simply because it's nurtured. We've got gardens, have we not? We nurture them, but our flowers aren't artificial ones. They're real. So love can be real, especially when it's nurtured, when it's increasing, when the right thoughts are there. However, I acknowledge it is very easy to cry, but how can I love someone who treats me badly? How can I treat someone who hardly has a word for me? Someone who comes in after work and seems to ignore me? How can I love someone who isn't kind or loving and who never thinks of me, one from one day to the next? And my only response to that is, when did God start loving you? Did Christ die for the godly or the ungodly? Love can be for those who are totally undeserving. Have we ever gone a day without praying? Have we ever ignored God and not read his word? Of course. And how can we say, you can't love someone who does that? God can. Through God's grace, we can. So, you older women, show the example to the younger women. And you younger women, learn to love your husbands. But we who are husbands, do not forget, we are commanded to love our wives. We are commanded to do that. The second of these seven aspects of the curriculum is loving your children. It seems odd to have to say this, but recent court cases remind us that there are mothers out there who do not love their children. There are mothers out there who bizarrely take pleasure in hurting and harming and killing their children. But again, this is something that can be developed. This is something that can be grown. It may not always come naturally. It may not always come easily. That little bundle of joy that comes home from the hospital. How soon it is that you need it, you realize it needs dealing with at both ends on a very regular basis. It's time consuming looking after this little thing. It's demanding, it's incessant, but you love him. You love her, don't you? It's your child. But there are occasions, I'm sure for any of us who are parents, we acknowledge that our children have exasperated us. Our children have annoyed us, and we've got angry with them. We've spoken to them harshly. Peter, who's having trouble doing up his shoelaces, and the time to go, well, that's come and gone, and we're getting later and later. How easy it is to say, "Why can't you hurry up?" Or simply push him out the way and say, "Oh, you'll never learn how to do this." Should we not instead think, love is patient? He cannot. He doesn't have the skills. And instead say something like, "Peter, I can see you're having trouble. Do you want me to help you?" Love goes that way. Loving your children thinks along those lines, instead of being abrupt and harsh and hurtful. But I suppose most of all we can remember that mothers and fathers should be loving towards their children, because they are a gift from God. Older women can teach younger women God's perspective on children, that they are a precious gift, and that there is no place for anything other than a tender love that cherishes the child and rejoices in him or her. And this is sometimes the situation which can bring that sadness and hurt that I mentioned earlier. An older woman can see a younger woman is struggling a little bit, is having a few difficulties with that extremely troublesome child. And you say, you just want to step in, and you do so. Lovingly, you think, as an older woman, but that younger woman, pride comes, bubbles up and says, "No, don't want any help. Thank you very much." Why? Why are we so prone to resenting any offers of help and advice? Are we able to do everything ourselves? Do we have the ability to work it all out? Of course not. But why then do we refuse that help, resisting every offer, and in the end making the situation worse? The third aspect of this curriculum that the older house should deal with for the younger children is that they are to be self-controlled. We spent a lot of time on that aspect a month ago, and I'm not going to go through it very much, except to point out really that being self-controlled is just being wise, putting godly wisdom into practice, having biblical priorities and making wise commitments. It's facing reality, knowing what you can and you can't afford, knowing what you can and you can't do. Thinking biblically is always a great asset, and in a difficult situation, in any difficult situation, should we not think that if there is an older person who can help, why not turn to them for advice, for help, for prayer? Or will we just shut ourselves in? Will we think, no, I'll do it myself? Are we ashamed to fail? Are we ashamed to let others know we are failing? Which of us at night can pray to God and say, thank you, God, that I didn't fail to get today? Can we honestly ever do that? Why can we not admit it to each other? Oh, by the way, I haven't forgotten that a month ago I set you women, you older women, a few challenges. Nor you older men, don't forget that. I said that to you as well, and that was the second set of homework I set you lot. And I haven't forgotten. How are you getting on at being living a godly lifestyle to those around you? Have other people noticed yet how much more godly we are becoming? Have others noticed that we are far more self-controlled? Have others noticed that we are exhibiting this dignity? Or has there been little change? Has there been no progress? You older women, again, has it been noticed that you are now more godly than you were a month ago? Reverent in your behaviour and the way you dress, the things you did. Did you show that, or have you shown that you are not a slave to anything? To drink, fashion, retail, therapy, food, chocolate? Where's it gone? What happened in this last month? Are you enslaved to anything? Paul says that these older women should not be slaves to much wine, but we broadened it, did we not? Slaves to anything. Television programs, romantic books, whatever. Are you more godly? Am I more godly than a month ago? Are we self-controlled? Has it made a difference? Have people noticed? That's the touchstone. Have people noticed? The fourth of these seven is purity. Pure. To be pure. God, we know, is holy. He is absolutely pure. He is free from all taint of imperfection in his thoughts, in his actions, in anything and everything he does. He is absolutely pure and holy. And he sent his Son into this world to redeem us from lawlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession. God has not sent Jesus Christ into this world to die on Calvary in order to have us wallowing in wickedness. He did not send him so we could enjoy sin. He sent him to take us out of those situations, to give us a different way of living. Purity. We are all, not just younger women, not just older women, but all of us are to be pure. But I think perhaps more so now than for many years and many centuries in the past, temptations to impurity, they come to the single as well as to the married. They may be different because of different levels of knowledge or experience, but impurity is an ever-present danger today. You walk down the road and you see advertisements, and on many of them you can see things you do not want to see. You log on to the internet and you think you're getting an ordinary news channel, and down the right or the left-hand side there are provocative images. You didn't want them to be there, but they are there. It is all too easy to let your mind wander into impurity instead of keeping it pure. And I'm sure that I think many films today include a steamy sex scene or they include nudity. Not because it enhances the plot, but in telling everyone there's this scene in it, it will attract people in to come and watch it, and they'll merely make money. phrase is sex sells, isn't it? But purity must start within. Christ himself said, what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this defiles a person. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a man, a person, from what comes from within. Purity starts within and works its way out. Sinful daydreaming, sexual fantasies, evil hard thoughts about others, lustful thoughts. These are sinful habits and they can be hard to break, but with God's grace it can be done. Impurity is not only in actions, it's also in the mind where no one else can see it. No one knows what's going on in your mind. No one knows what thoughts you may have except yourself and God, who sees all. And every impure thought needs to be replaced with the right godly thought. We are, as Paul says in Romans, to make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. That might mean no watching soap operas full of excitement and immorality. It might mean that we don't read romantic novels such as, and I only know the name, I've never read any myself, produced by Mills and Boone. Not watching an awful lot of films because of the images they put into our minds. Pornography obviously is out. But any impure thought, anything that is less than the perfect should be shunned, should be put away. And we should not ever rejoice in that which is wrong, that which is evil, but only rejoice in the truth. I'm sure that there are people today who, they will never make any appointment if it clashes with their favourite soap opera. There are many, many who will not go out because they'll miss an episode and they must have their daily fix of excitement or immorality. They must have that. And to teaching others in our society to be pure, to remain pure, is a huge, huge challenge. And it's not easy. And men, I've been talking about women so far. You may not have noticed it, but this is for women. But men, how do you and I fare when it comes to having pure minds? How clear are we from impure thoughts? What do we watch? What do we read? What do we imagine? Be holy, for I am holy, says the Lord. Purity may not be popular today, but for the Christian, it's essential. The fifth aspect is working at home. And this could be the second most contentious aspect of this evening's sermon and of Paul's sevenfold syllabus. Should a Christian mother ever go out to work? There are easy answers. Never. If she wants to, she can do it. Those are the easy answers. But along with most easy answers, they can be wrong answers. And they can be, because they are so dogmatic, they can produce very many complications. I think it is very much a question of absolute necessity and of levels of commitment. God wants women, mothers, to stay at home, to commit themselves to caring for their home and their family, making sure that the home is clean and organized and orderly. She is to set the tone, but husbands and children obviously are not exempt, but she sets the tone. And through her labours, through her work in the home, I think it's probably true that it's her abilities that turns the house into the home. It's her abilities that bring warmth and personality into the home. She is the one who looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness, as we read in Proverbs. She obviously is an organized person. She has a structured day and night, a routine of shopping and cleaning and all the rest of it. And older women, you can help. You can help the younger woman to do all these things, to learn how to do all these things by passing on your household tips or household management tips, so that things can be done more efficiently or more practically. And those can spread around a church, and there should be no shame, no fear in taking them on board if they would benefit you in your home. You see, Paul doesn't say that women are only to work in the home. They are to be working at home. It's not so much that a woman's place is in the home, but that it is her responsibility for the home. That's her responsibility. That's her area of prime labour for the Lord. Now, feminists would rail against this notion, describing it as that slavery, that bondage that I mentioned earlier. But I think if we look, better homes are those that are results of that level of commitment of the young mother. It's to the home first. Not necessarily to the exclusion of all else, but it must be to the home that the woman is committed. Train these younger women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, to be pure, to be working at home, kind. Kindness. In the life of a Titus 2 woman, you will find good works. But it's not just for the women, it's for all of us. There at the end of verse 14, we have that Christ has purified a possession for himself who are zealous for good works. It is something for every Christian, not just for women. But have you ever come across the person, you've asked them to do you a small favour, and they say, well, I would, but I've got to do this, 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 and, oh, I've just remembered I've got that and that as well. So sorry, I can't do it for you. Well, would you be able to do it the next day? Oh, no, I've got my schedule and I daren't change it. I've got too many things to do, and if my schedule's upset, well, I'll never be able to do anything for the rest of the... Nothing will be right the whole week long. Sorry, can't help. What a contrast to the person who says, when you ask them, can you do me this little favour on Tuesday morning? They say, well, I was going to do. How long will it take? Yeah, I'll help you. I can do it for you. Good works. Kindness. How ready are we to help others out, even if it causes us a few problems? Do we resent it? Our plans, our lives are made a bit more difficult. What about an even worse scenario? Someone always wants to be asked but never is asked. How easy it is to offend. You older women, when you are asked, can you do someone a favour? Do you demonstrate compassion for them? Generosity? Kind words, when you respond to their request, are you gentle with them? Do you demonstrate love to them? Are you helpful? Are you softly spoken? Or are you harsh and selfish, hard-hearted? Because you come first, your plans, your schemes, what you want. And of course, I'm sure that if you show the younger women how to develop kindness in their lives, how to just to treat other people, I'm sure you will begin to develop more and more kindness in your own life as well. Number 7. Last one. Submissive to their own husbands. It's been a long time getting to it. But we have reached what I think is probably the most controversial of these 7 instructions. But there is no honest way to get round this verse and others like it. Wives, Paul wrote in Ephesians, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. And in Colossians, wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. And what did Peter write? Wives, be subject to your own husbands. Do not let your adorning be external, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Yes, you can refuse to accept this statement. But if you do, you want to rip up the New Testament. You want to remove God's plans. To the world, submission is abhorrent. To the feminist, there's nothing you could say that would be a greater insult than to say you should be submissive, or wives should be submissive to their husbands. You're likely to get their hands around your throat if you can't get back soon enough. But the notion is not one of servility, abject fear. It's one of willingly functioning under the authority and leadership of another. Think of the army, or any of the armed forces. Captains obey majors. Not because the major is a better person. Not because he's more handsome. Not because he's richer. They don't obey him because his orders are good and right and proper and sensible. Or most of all, because the captain happens to agree with them. They obey them simply because they come from an officer who has authority. That's it, isn't it? There is a level of authority involved. A major may call the captains under him to a conference and explain, this is what we're going to do and this is how I think we should do it, and the captains can chip in and make suggestions. Perhaps, we don't know, but when it comes down to it, the major says, this is what we will do. And the captains in their minds may think, I don't know if I like that, but that is what I will do. Simply because there is that duly constituted authority that says, this is the way to go. And they do it. The captains aren't inferior. They're not lesser beings because they're obedient ones. When a decision is made, it is to be followed. That decision may be popular or unpopular, liked or not, agreed with or not. But the responsibility to make the decision in a family lies with the husband. And the authority comes from God himself, because he has constituted the family. And that's why feminists hate this idea. Because they wish to tear God off his throne and replace him with their own God, who will be a woman. They wish to invert the whole structure that God has put into this world. There are structures. There are levels of authority. And God is saying that in the family, the authority to make the final decision lies with the husband. And it is the wife's loving duty, loving responsibility. It's because she loves her husband that she says yes. That's what we will do. Now, I'm not saying that there can never be any sort of suggestion, any question. Do you think that's the best thing? Do you think that's really wise? Perhaps older women can help the younger women by providing some sort of, I wouldn't say pro forma, but a structure of words that would start with something like, can we think again just for a moment about whatever it might be? But, you know, whatever you decide, I'll go along with it. How much worse it is if not only questioning decisions, but you rake up old decisions. Can you imagine an army where the major says to the captains, go on, this is what we're going to do. We're going to advance up that hill and round that and so on. And the captain says, don't like it, won't do it, sorry. It's the wrong choice. We should be going the other way. What will happen? Will any action against the enemy ever take place? Of course it won't. They'll be overrun by the enemy instead of making progress themselves, because they are fighting in the family, in the army. And if old decisions are raked up in the army, well, this decision is no better than the one you made last year. This decision is as rubbish as the one you... Well, I told you about it last time, didn't I? And still you want to do the same thing again? Do you think, no, we can't do this? Such infighting. Such will never, never enable the Christian family to flourish. In the face of such disruption, the devil will be laughing. If a woman loves her husband, she will respect him and his decisions, even if they're not popular. And godly older women should be an example of being joyfully, being biblically submissive to their husbands, and demonstrating that they recognize God's plan for the family. I think Paul states it so bluntly here because the women on Crete were not very submissive. He's correcting their ideas and their approach. He's wanting them to realize that family decision making is something that is collaborative, but when a decision needs to be made, it is the husband who makes that decision, and that is the best way forward, and it's the blessed way forward. Animosity, resentment, that feeling of never being treated properly. No, they cannot, they will never enable any marriage to portray the Christian life as it should be. Rather, it will be seen as a failure. You see, there are people out there who can read the scriptures, and they can see these phrases, these instructions of Paul. And they say, Christians should do these things. These Christians don't do these things. These Christians aren't pure. These Christians aren't kind. These Christian women don't submit to their husbands. These Christian women don't love their children. Doesn't say much for their Christianity, does it? Doesn't say much for their God. Paul does give that reason. Do these things, there at the end of verse 5, do these things that the word of God may not be reviled. Do our lives adorn the gospel of God? Or do they let others revile the word of God and reject it because they can see it's made no difference to us, and therefore it can't make any difference to them? We say it can save from sin. It can change lives. It can make you into a different person. And they see that we aren't different. Our lives have not changed. That's Paul's challenge. Here is a sevenfold syllabus for women. And it should be followed, simply because God says this is good. But also, there is that aspect of the evangelistic nature of the lives that we live. Are our Christian lives going to make a difference? Or are we living sham lives? We say one thing and we do the opposite. For people to be convinced that the gospel changes, we need to be pure. We need to be kind. We need to be loving. Otherwise they can justly say, it's no good, because it hasn't changed her. It hasn't helped him. It's not worth listening to. How will the lost ever be drawn to Jesus Christ if our lives will repel them? How will they learn? We can preach all we want. We can use the best techniques. But if our words are not backed up by our lives, then those words are likely to fall on deaf ears.